Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You may remember it, the day 17 years ago when the cable channels and networks broke away from their regular programming to go live to a Long Island beach with news that a TWA jumbo jet had exploded midair. All on board, 230 lives lost. Out on the horizon, helicopters and ships searching for wreckage, children's sneakers washing onto the beach, and a whole lot of eyewitnesses who said they saw streaks of light, like missiles, shooting up toward the plane just before the fireball. The official finding was no missile, but a fuel tank explosion. My guests today don't believe it. This hour on Point, what brought down TWA Flight 800? You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Do you remember TWA Flight 800? Are you satisfied with the official explanation? Do we make ourselves crazy looking again, or is it important? Here's a scene courtesy of Epics TV from the opening moments of Tom Stalkup's documentary, TWA Flight 800. The voices you hear are of residents in and around East Mauritius on Long Island describing what they saw as they went about their business at 8:30 that July night 17 years ago.
It was a very warm night, and it was kind of stifling almost.
We were taking a walk that evening.
We were taking a nice night flight.
I was walking with a friend of mine.
I was standing on the dock, and I was looking out in a southeasterly direction.
I was on my boat.
I was at Michut Beach.
We just happened to look up at the sky.
And all of a sudden, I see something rise up from behind these trees over here.
What was that something? Here's a montage from the documentary again. It airs July 17th, the 17th anniversary, on Epics TV, courtesy of Epics News Reports from that night.
The U.S. Coast Guard tonight is reporting an explosion about 10 miles south of Long Island.
747 was on its way to Paris from JFK in New York.
We now have it that TWA Flight 800, a commercial 747 aircraft carrying 212 passengers, a crew of 17, has exploded in midair about 10 miles out into the Atlantic Ocean.
Very visible from Long Island. What did they see? Here's more.
Just happened to look up in the sky.
And I see something that's going across right in my line of sight.
I actually see something behind a tree line, more or less like my thumb, go up in the air.
I saw what appeared to be cheap fireworks.
I noticed a streak of light heading up towards the sky.
I saw this white light shoot up in the sky.
There again from TWA Flight 800, the documentary that airs July 17th on Epics. With us right now from New York is Tom Stalkup, a physicist by training. He's never accepted the official NTSB report, which is why he founded a group, the Flight 800 Independent Researchers Organization, and he has co-produced a new documentary airing July 17th on Epics, the 17th anniversary of the crash of TWA Flight 800. Tom Stalkup, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
It was my pleasure.
Also with us from Washington is Hank Hughes, former senior accident investigator for the National Transportation Safety Board. He was chairman of the Airplane Interior Documentation Group that reconstructed Flight 800's interior as part of the investigation. You may remember the images of it spread all over that enormous hangar on Long Island. He figures prominently in Tom Stalkup's documentary. Hank Hughes, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Hank, how's it going?
It's good to have both of you here, and congratulations on putting this together. Plenty of controversy about your conclusion. Again, fierce denials of where you point from those who were involved then. Hank, remind us just how much time in your life you spent in the air investigation business?
Well, I was with the National Transportation Safety Board for 26 years, but prior to that I was a police investigator for 12 years, and prior to that I spent 4 years in Army counterintelligence.
And remind us just how deeply involved you were in the post-follow-up investigation of Flight 800's downing or crash?
I was a member of the GO team. We're the first group to respond to the accident scene. We got there early in the morning right after the explosion. And within a day or two, I was assigned the task of establishing a reconstruction area for the aircraft. I did that at the hangar that we were able to procure and basically set up a layout area, an evidence reception and evaluation area. And then a few weeks into the collection and layout work, I was directed to reconstruct the inside of the airplane, which we did in a separate hangar. By the way, you probably haven't seen much of that on TV because it wasn't publicized, but we used a separate hangar about 300 yards from the main hangar
for the interior. I guess it's the exterior we saw, yeah.
Yes, you did, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Tom Stalkup, Hank is just one of, you've got a half dozen or so people who were involved in the investigation, and some of them who are quite strong in saying that they don't agree with the outcome, the conclusion of that investigation. Why have you picked all this up again, Tom, all these years later?
Well, since grad school, I've never really been satisfied with the official scenario. I found it shocking, as does Hank and the rest of the whistleblowers, that not one out of 670 eyewitnesses, those witnesses that you just heard on your lead into the show, mm-hmm. not one of those was ever allowed to testify at a public hearing. And that's just been one of the many, many things that make me very suspicious about the official cause of this investigation.
There's a lot we want to look at in this hour, and we will hear from another member of the board of the NTSB who says, look, we got it right, you guys are on the wrong track, but what was the explanation for not hearing from eyewitnesses to this aircraft coming down so close to shore that it was easily seen? You couldn't miss it if you were looking up there, I guess, Tom. Why weren't they? Why didn't they testify?
It was a carefully orchestrated effort. 3 weeks before the final hearing, the FBI released a CIA animation. None of the people in the CIA interviewed witnesses, but they came up with an animation saying that they didn't see a missile. What they saw was the plane climbing sharply, and it looked like a missile, without interviewing any one of them. So then they let a couple of weeks go by. 5 days before that public hearing, chaired by Chairman Hall, FBI Assistant Director James Carlstrom wrote a letter requesting that no eyewitness testify. And his reasoning was, well, we have a FBI criminal investigation going on. But the problem with that is, 2 weeks earlier, he suspended that criminal investigation, so that was no longer valid. But that is the reason they gave.
And, of course, you have in the documentary, you talk with a lot of eyewitnesses, many of whom are clearly still disturbed all these years later about what they saw and the conclusion the NTSB reached. At least one who says she was more or less told not to talk about it. Here's Phyllis Torney. She was an eyewitness to a TWA 800 coming down in 1996. She described years later to the filmmakers what happened when the FBI interviewed her in her home, and she stuck to her story that she'd seen a light streaking up in the sky before the plane exploded. Here's Phyllis Torney from TWA Flight 800, the documentary.
Days later, the FBI came to visit, and they sat down, and they were talking to me, and they were asking me questions, and I told them my story, and he had his little pad. And then when the interview was over, they looked at me and they said, you have your papers in to become an American citizen, don't you? And I said, yes, I'm waiting to be called. They said, well, it would be very wise of you if you want to become an American citizen to keep very quiet about this and not to talk about it.
Not to talk about it. They're from the documentary. Tom Stalkup is co-producer. Hank Hughes figures prominently as a one-time investigator of all this. There's a lot of physical evidence beyond the eyewitness accounts that is very much the substance of your documentary. Hank, I wish you'd just lay out for us to remind everybody, and of course we'll have plenty of listeners who were maybe not even born then or, you know, barely old enough to follow what happened then. What was the official conclusion about what happened, the official conclusion about what happened that evening 10 miles off Long Island?
Well, the safety board's official conclusion was that the center fuel tank exploded as a result of an electrical short or malfunction of an electrical component in the center fuel tank. Yet, even at the board hearing, at the final, what we call the sunshine meeting, investigator who was responsible for the systems investigation to cover the area of the center fuel tank and electrical systems had to admit there was no evidence found that in fact was the cause.
So that would depict this as what something internal to the airplane had set off that enormous store of fuel that was just behind the front end of the aircraft?
Actually, it was right below the center wing area, mm-hmm. where the wing box is, where the wings meet. But it's a large area, probably 6 feet deep. The width of the airplane, and probably from the front of the wing to the back of the wing, if you get an idea how large it is. It had four metal walls in it, baffles to keep the fuel from sloshing around. And at the time of the explosion, we were able to estimate, based on fuel consumption and the load, that the airplane would have had about a half an inch of fuel in the bottom of this tank. The fuel, I might also add...
Most fuel would be out on the wings at that point, you're saying.
Yes, and... Mm. I might also add that the airplane had been fueled in Italy, and an additive, an inhibitor was added to the fuel, basically as an additional protection.
We'll look at what that might mean, and a lot more here. Tom Stalkup, I remember this went on for years. All those pieces laid out and so much investigation. You provide a lot of evidence and people kind of testifying to you here, but why would the government want to cover up a real reason, maybe the real reason for this airplane's crash? Why?
Well, we don't really speculate in the documentary, but we do provide a lot of evidence that this was a missile. The eyewitnesses were right. The metallurgical evidence of punctures going into the aircraft means something. The explosive residues found throughout the wreckage mean something. For some reason, well, if we're right, and if this is true, and it's not what the government says, then I think that might be the motive. If we're right, I think it's not out of the ordinary to think that they may have another reason for covering this up.
Tom Stalkup is with us. He's co-producer of the new documentary TWA Flight 800. It will air July 17th on the on-demand TV channel Epix. It's the 17th anniversary of the crash. Hank Hughes is with us, former senior accident investigator with the National Transportation Safety Board. He was right in the middle of this investigation. Here from the documentary is FBI explosives expert Bob Heckman in the Epix TV documentary, recalling how the FBI interviewed hundreds of eyewitnesses who consistently told of seeing a bright light streaking up into the sky in the seconds before the fireball.
The initial witness statements all indicated that it might have been a missile because they were all describing seeing a streaking object in the sky and then a big fireball.
Of course, experts say experience and careful research have shown again and again that eyewitness accounts of unusual events can vary greatly and can contradict each other and ultimately can be inaccurate. Still, in this documentary, the eyewitness accounts are startlingly consistent.
It was moving very rapidly.
It was fast.
Zoop, just like that.
It's going very quickly. It's very, very shiny.
Kind of like a little smoke plume behind it. It
looked like a missile vapor trail to me.
Then it turns to the left.
Then it turned.
And it arced over.
It looked like it curved to the right.
Then it momentarily disappeared.
Disappeared for a second or two.
And it sort of disappeared from my vision.
And then I lost it because there was some clouds. And then I saw it again.
So it's up, and there was a plane that was flying along.
And I saw a flash of an aircraft light. Blink, blink, blink.
Until, boom. And it all came down. The montage there from Tom Stalkup's TWA Flight 800 documentary. Tom, put in your own words what they're talking about there. It was not hard to see. Where were most of the eyewitnesses? Which way were they looking? Where was the plane? And what was it that they're describing?
Right. Well, the situation was it was 8:30 at night on the Hamptons in Long Island. It's a beautiful evening. Lots of people were still at the beaches. The sun had just set because the sun sets a lot later in July. And so it was still light out, and these people had a perfectly clear view. It was a clear day, except for a few little clouds here and there. And they saw what they just said. Something went up and outbound, turned to the left. And other people from different perspectives said, as it turned to the right, depending on where you are in Long Island.
Right.
Long Island is, you know, it's very,
very long,
and it was traveling parallel to the coast. Mm-hmm. You also had an Air National Guard helicopter pilot who was in the air at the time, who you heard just now saying it looked like a vapor trail to me. Well, his name is Major Fred Meyer, and he flew overland rescues in Vietnam. And he saw missiles in flight before, and he says what he saw was a missile, as does his co-pilot.
So something went up. Does anybody deny that there was something? Is there video of that? These days, everything's on video. Everybody's got a cell phone, or is it?
Well, yeah, back then they didn't. It was 1996. But, you know, they'll tell you what there was a video of. 5 days before the crash, there was someone on top of a hospital. And he was an AC technician, and he just loved videoing things. And he was videoing things about 5 days before the crash, around 4 in the morning, and captured what looked like a missile going up. He provided that to the FBI, and they confirmed through the Defense Intelligence Agency that there was a missile on his videotape. And so that videotape exists. It might not exist anymore because we asked for it, and they said they can't find it. They looked where it's supposed to be, and they can't find it.
What about the radar records? Does it show that something went up in the vicinity of this plane, or would it show or not?
Good question. The answer is no. Very unlikely. Missiles themselves are like stealth fighters. They got rounded surfaces. They're not very good at reflecting radar signals. And in fact, the NTSB conducted a study in 2000 where they launched missiles and tried to record them on radar, and they couldn't. The only thing they were able to record was the explosion after the missile detonates. When that happens, the surfaces, of course, are no longer rounded, and they can reflect radar signals. Well, in the case of Flight 800, remember what I just said. These witnesses said this object traveled outbound. Well, once that missile exploded, that's when it was picked up. And there's an outbound debris consistent with the eyewitness accounts, which we calculated to be exiting the area of the aircraft in excess of Mach 4. Now, the NTSB theory relies on a low-velocity fuel-air explosion. So that alone is a smoking gun. That disproves the NTSB theory alone, just the radar evidence.
Hank Hughes, there were process issues which are talked about in the documentary, and also physical evidence issues. And, of course, the view that Tom is putting out there is sharply disputed by the NTSB and more. But let's talk about each of those for a second. Just in simple terms, when this was all collected at great expense and effort from the ocean floor and laid out in those hangars on Long Island, what were the key elements of physical evidence that came to the fore that have helped shape your questions about the official conclusion, Hank?
Well, I think the physical evidence, unfortunately, was tampered with, and it was handled improperly, both by the FBI and the NTSB. There have been long-established protocols for transportation accident investigation. They were violated. The NTSB basically chose to ignore their own rules because they acquiesced to the FBI's dictates. And when I say that, I remember the first day I was in the hangar, there were two NTSB investigators, about 40 FBI agents, and about 30 ATF agents sitting at picnic benches in the corner because the FBI wouldn't allow them to do anything, although the ATF has significantly more experience in explosion investigation than the FBI does. But the violation of investigative protocols happened almost immediately. The parties to the investigation, for instance, to the NTSB investigation, were denied access to information. They were not provided with daily updates as to all aspects of the investigation, which has been a hallmark of the safety board for years. It's worked really well. The problem was the FBI was providing a lot of stovepipe investigative information. You know, one level would pass it up to the next, but they weren't talking to the guy next door to them. The safety board's procedure has always been horizontal. We share information. Factual information is not something that's denied. And at TWA, it from day one was a problem.
So process was an issue. You weren't the only one who felt that. There's a bit in the documentary where a former fighter pilot and commercial pilot for TWA, James Spear, who represented the Airline Pilots Association in the investigation, is describing the scene at the Coast Guard station there in East Mauritius on Long Island as the investigation unfolded. And he says here his first impression as this came together was martial law.
There were approximately 1,000 cops at scene there, of which half of them were FBI agents. They had guards on the hangar, they had cops at the Coast Guard station, and it seemed very unusual for an accident investigation.
Of course, Tom Stalkup, you've had people come back at this documentary and say, well, of course it was. And the reason it was unusual precisely because authorities were worried that this might have been a terrorist attack sometime. And so, yes, there was a full court press on here. Yes, it was almost martial law. They were trying to button it down to in case it had been a terrorist attack. What about that, Tom? Have you got it backwards?
Oh, I don't think so at all. I mean, certainly if you believe it was terrorism, you should send in your best people. And they did send in some people, but they I don't think were their best people. We, like Hank documented, actually testified before the Senate. Some of the FBI agents were caught hammering on pieces of wreckage to flatten it. And that's documented in Senate testimony before Charles Grassley in 1999. So decisions were made by the FBI. Yes, they should have investigated this thoroughly if they thought it was a criminal act, and I don't think that's surprising. But the overwhelming presence of the FBI and the intimidation, not only of the eyewitnesses, but of the NTSB investigators, was not valid. The only time the FBI has a legal authority to do that, to push the NTSB aside, is if they acknowledge that the aircraft was had evidence of a criminal act. That was never done. The NTSB was always the lead agency on the crash legally, but they never had that role in the first, what, Hank, about 6 months or so?
Until such time as Mr. Kallstrom declared that it wasn't a criminal act. So I probably about 6 or 8 months, yes.
Out of the FBI. Of course, you can't know until you do some investigation what it is. Tom, let me put to you the same question. Your theory is it was a missile, or if I understand your eyewitnesses correctly, maybe more than one missile, maybe three missiles. What's the physical evidence that you are suggesting the documentary was there to support that theory of the case, Tom?
Well, let me just start by saying there was no evidence of a missile impact, and that may shock your readers, but I mean your listeners, sorry. But what that means is there's no evidence of a missile getting in contact with the plane and exploding. Those types of missiles are called contact fuse missiles, and the terrorists use them. But the other
they
type
just
of
get
missile,
close and explode is the idea, and then and well, that knocks out the target.
Yeah, well, there's a fuse on the thing. Once it contacts something, whatever it hits, then it will explode. There are other types of missiles.
Oh, I see.
Which are there are other types that actually, when they get close, they use their own onboard radar to determine how close they are to a target, and they explode at a significant distance from that aircraft or target. And that is where we have the evidence of. That would shower the target with pellets and pieces of the missile parts and also create a big shock wave that would create these high-velocity fractures and also the holes, the internal penetrations from outside the aircraft, inside the aircraft. Now, those fractures called spike tooth fractures were found throughout the aircraft. Holes from different directions coming into the aircraft were documented.
So that's one piece of evidence, the array of holes. What else, Tom?
Okay. They found explosive residues all over the plane. Over 100 hits they found, the FBI found, and these were confirmed by the Aegis detection machine. Our documentary interviewed the inventor of that machine, and he confirmed to us that it does not have false positives. So these were all positive detections of explosives, approximately 100 detections throughout the wreckage. As Hank might tell you right now, at some point when they started getting all these many, many positive hits, they told them to stop doing chemical swabbing.
Who told whom to stop doing chemical swabbing, Hank?
The FBI instructed their agents who were there representing the evidence recovery teams. I might also add that early on when I established the reconstruction area, I had a reception area for parts. And the idea was to identify the parts and at the same time swab them for explosive residue and also run some of the component parts like furnishings in the interior of the airplane through an X-ray. The FBI agreed with that, and we started to do that. And for a matter of a week or two, the process was going well. And then all of a sudden, I realized that the seats, for instance, that had foreign bodies in them, or you know, projectiles, pieces of aircraft part and people, were being thrown in an old trailer. The refrigerated trailer, and then ultimately they forgot to fuel the trailer, and we had to go dumpster diving, but to get the parts out. But they commingled all of the the parts that they were taking out of the seats, and to some extent the same thing happened with the medical examiner's office. Instead of documenting the angle of penetration and what it was, it was just extracted, thrown in a jar or an evidence envelope, and that was the end of it. And it absolutely shouldn't have been done that way. It violates any acceptable protocol.
Tom, authorities say that the explosives found on the airplane were due to a bomb-sniffing dog exercise that had taken place on this plane in St. Louis before it arrived in New York for that flight to Paris.
Well, that's another false story. Well, there's two things that you can discount that story with. First of all, the first piece of wreckage that the Aegis machine detected a positive hit on was on the right wing. Now, if they had a bomb detection exercise inside the passenger cabin, the person having that exercise had no way of spilling explosives on the right wing. And this was, of course, 2 weeks before the crash when the vacuums would have gone through there several times. There's no way for it to get outside the aircraft on the right wing. Secondly, we did some research on this years and years ago, and I even interviewed Kallstrom about that, and he said he knew about this bad information earlier, but he went with it anyway, is what he told me. And this information is that the flight that would become Flight 800 was in St. Louis, and it was being boarded by 400 passengers on their way to Honolulu at the time of the alleged exercise. But the person who conducted the exercise said he conducted it on a completely empty 747. The adjacent gate had an empty 747 available for the exercise, and we believe that's the plane he conducted his exercise on.
We're going to hear in just a moment from John Golia, whose signature was on the final report and who disputes much of what conclusions are reached in the new documentary. Lewis is calling from Lunenburg, Massachusetts. Lewis, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I love the show. I just want to say I remember this day very clearly, maybe because I'm a news junkie, but I remember it. And I also remember that there were eyewitness accounts of what appeared to be missiles. And you know, it's just so flash forward to this point in time when to put it bluntly, the credibility of the FBI is under scrutiny. Look at the Whitey Bulger trial and so on and so forth. We hire the FBI by voting in the people that appoint them, I guess, but they're not accountable to us. And it seems to me that in this day and age, we more than ever need to know what's going on. And so I'm very interested in this documentary, and I can't wait to hear it. And thank you very much.
Lewis, I appreciate your call. Tom, why wouldn't the FBI have wanted the truth to come out?
Well, again, that's speculation, but I think
you suggested very powerfully here. So, but why, if that's the case, why?
Well, remember, I'm not going to speculate, but I will tell you some information that might help your listeners understand. The FBI, within 2 weeks of the crash, just like your listener, heard about these witnesses. They interviewed them directly, and within 2 weeks, they were finalizing a report saying there was a high probability a missile was involved. Now, James Kallstrom, the director and the assistant director who was in charge of the investigation, never released that statement publicly and instead went to the CIA. We have internal CIA documents saying that they did know that the FBI was saying this early on. But now, instead of letting the FBI speak for the witnesses, they let the CIA team say what the witnesses saw in the form of an animation. And as I said earlier, none of the CIA team members interviewed a single eyewitness.
How did that CIA animation strike you, Tom?
Well, that's what sort of got me into this whole thing. I was a graduate student down at Florida State University attempting to get my PhD in physics, which I ended up getting. But at that time, I was on my couch just watching TV, and I saw the animation, and it was very odd. It seemed very strange that the CIA was trying to tell me and the rest of the world what happened to this plane.
With big letters on the screen, I think they said, no missiles, no missiles. And maybe that's right. Tom Stalkup's documentary suggests strongly otherwise. It is TWA Flight 800, 230 lives lost. Hank Hughes is with us as well. He was an investigator on the case. You can join this conversation. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about TWA Flight 800, all 230 dead off the coast of Long Island in July 1996, in a new documentary that again questions why it came down, fuel tank explosion or mysterious missile strike. It will air on July 17th, the 17th anniversary of the crash, on the on-demand TV channel Epix. Congress held hearings on the crash and subsequent investigation. Here's Ohio Congressman Democrat James Traficant going after the NTSB chairman, then Jim Hall, on explosives and whether they had found evidence of explosive traces on the wreckage.
First question, Mr. Hall. To this point, is there any physical evidence, conclusive forensic physical evidence, to prove that it was a mechanical failure that caused the explosion of the center fuel tank? Yes or no? I heard a lot
no,
of testimony.
But we're looking at that. There are things
no,
that we...
I want a one-question answer. I know this is tough. At this point...
Yeah. No.
Okay. Mr. Carlstrom, were there, in fact, traces of PETN and RDX found in that plane wreckage?
There were explosive chemicals found.
No to evidence of that proved it was a mechanical failure. Yes, there were explosive chemicals found. Now, there were explanations for those, but... In the documentary, they talked to the Merritt Berkey, the NTSB's lead fire and explosives investigator, saying that traces of nitrates found on the plane's debris could have come from explosives, but also could have come from a lot of other compounds. To pin down the origins of those nitrates would have required a lot more testing.
You didn't order the follow-up testing.
No, I didn't.
Why?
I don't have a recollection of why, other than to say that we didn't do it.
230 lives lost. John Golia joins us in a couple of seconds here. A couple calls first. Bob in Bloomington, Indiana. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, your guests may have already talked on this subject, but without a motive or even speculation of a motive, I just don't understand the point of bringing it all back up. Because, I mean, people botch investigations. Agencies don't talk to each other. Things go wrong. Stuff happens. We're human. But without any credible motive or even an idea of a motive, I just don't see the relevance other than just it's a time for conspiracy theories.
Yeah. Tom Stalkup, how about it? Without a motive, why bring it up?
Well, motive for what? Motive for the cover-up or motive for the accident?
Bob?
Well, I would say motive for the cover-up. I mean, motive for the accident is hardly anything that we could get at. But, I mean, if there was a cover-up, if they did this on purpose, if there was witness intimidation, then there's got to be a motive for that.
Well, could we just stipulate right here that a lot of the speculation, and this is speculation, Bob, was that there would be some kind of U.S. military missile that might have gone up or a terrorist missile. But if it was U.S., it's easy to see why that would be embarrassing, isn't it, Bob? Though that's not proven here, to your point.
No, it's not really. I mean, I can see what you're saying, and I can see why it would be. But when lives are lost to that extent, I think people get past embarrassment. You know, they admit mistakes, they admit fault, you know, because it really comes down to that point. I hate to use pat terms, but compassion and patriotism.
Well, yeah, but Tom Stalkup, how about it? If you can't tie the downing to an embarrassing mishap or security lapse of some kind, then you don't have a motive for the government to close it, to cover up, do you?
Well, I kind of reject that, but I do understand what he's saying. You would expect so many 230 people dying that they, regardless of what happened, they would give the truth. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so involved in this over these years, is that obviously if you watch the documentary, you'll see that the truth was actually subverted. They didn't allow a single eyewitness to testify. Now those are facts. Now, to say motive, I think... Tom, you gave a good explanation for that. Now, that is speculation, but we're not going to do that. But if it's true what you said, Tom, then I can think of some reasons why that they would cover that up. Now, I think they would be irresponsible, and I think they should be exposed if that happened. And that's what I think opening this investigation will get to. And that's what we're trying to do, just reopen the investigation, the NTSB, have an honest look at this, and to find out exactly what happened based on the evidence, based on the eyewitnesses, without any intimidation, without evidence leaving the investigation.
But at this point, there's not proof. It is speculation about the sort of missile, maybe from the Navy theory. Lots of things were thrown around at the time. 4 years of investigation, and the official result came out, no. Here it is. It was the center fuel tank. Tom Stalkup, Hank Hughes, please stand by. With us right now from Hyderabad, India, is John Golia. He served on the board of the NTSB from August 95 to June 2004, worked very closely on the investigation of the TWA 800 crash. As such, his signature is on the NTSB's official accident report on TWA Flight 800. Before that, he was an airframe and power plant mechanic for United Airlines, U.S. Air. He's now a writer for Aviation International News. John Golia, thank you very much for joining us today from Hyderabad, India, no less. You've said that the theory put forward in this documentary is just plain ridiculous. Why do you say that, John?
Well, if you see this documentary, at the very end, we now have three missiles instead of one. If we start from the beginning, we talk about eyewitnesses' reports like they're infallible, and we all know that they are not infallible. People mistake what they see. I don't doubt that they saw something. I don't know what they saw. But the physical evidence to support what they think they saw just was not there.
How is it that Hank Hughes is on with us? You know that he and others in the documentary conclude otherwise. How can we presume well-meaning investigators, all with a lot of background experience, come to such divergent conclusions about such an important investigation, John?
That's not uncommon. The discussions that go on within the NTSB after major accidents oftentimes can get quite heated. There's always differences of opinion. There's always different views on what their piece of the wreckage means. Results. I mean, Hank did a tremendous amount of work on the interior of the airplane, but there were others that were doing the structures and doing other areas of the airplane. I mean, it's a massive effort, a lot of people involved. And yes, in the beginning, there was a lot of disruption because the FBI believed it was a criminal act, and they have to maintain chain of custody of material. And let's not forget, it's one thing to maintain a chain of custody for material when you're dealing with government employees, but many of the people that were in the hangar with a badge of the NTSB on that were not government employees, and two of the other people that have been talking about this with Hank are not government employees, and they really didn't have any rights as far as the FBI is concerned to demand anything until it became an NTSB investigation.
John, let me ask you, how do you account for the evidence of explosives on the plane, for the high-velocity fractures that Tom Stalkop suggests are evidence of something coming in from outside, the fragments flying away from the plane at Mach 4 faster than a centered fuel tank explosion would have unfolded?
Well, the radar people are going to have to tell what they see there. All I know is what I read and observed on the radar demonstrations that we saw, and what I was told by personal friends of mine who saw the raw data before anybody really had their hands on it. And most of those people, I mean all of them that I talked to, said that there was no missile. Now, when you talk about a man pad,
That is a shoulder-fired missile that's heat-seeking, maybe?
Correct. To catch an airplane at 13,800 feet, very, very difficult. And I was actually told way back in 97 that we really didn't have a missile that could do that from a shoulder-fired position, that it would take a much larger missile. And as I watched the documentary, and it was explained they had one missile that was chasing around, circled around the airplane.
Yep.
I was told specifically that there was no missile that could do that short of 14 inches in diameter, which would mean a heck of a lot more than a shoulder-fired missile.
Well, there was also talk in the film about a substantial ship offshore that eyewitnesses saw that night. I suppose it wouldn't have to be shoulder-fired, John.
Right, that's true. But then we would have some evidence of it. The bigger the missile, the bigger the radar return. And then when you get to the airplane, let's talk about the airplane itself.
Yes, please.
When you get to the airplane, if we have a proximity fuse, and that's the type of fuse he was talking about that explodes near the airplane, you have shrapnel, much like a shotgun. It shoots out at high velocity and makes big holes in the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
You also have an overpressure that can destroy metal by the fact of the overpressure.
Yep.
But if we In the film, they talk about overpressure on top of the wing, but yet also on top of the wing, inboard, is thin-skinned aluminum that experienced no such deformation. That would have been really bent in a manner different than what we found and have found, and you can still see on the recreation of that airplane down in Virginia.
Hank Hughes, what do you say to John Golia's different interpretation of what's there and what's not there in the evidence?
Well, let me begin by saying that I worked for John for a short period of time, and we're friends. I have the utmost respect for him. With all due respect, I disagree, and I base that on my day-to-day observations in both hangars, I might add. I spent most of my time in the interior, but I also spent a considerable amount of time working with the structures folks. If you look at the sequence of events, the event sequencing that was done by the safety board, and then you look at the information that was not available to the board, in particular, in addition to the witness statements, which are very powerful, many of whom I think can be very accurate, as well as the fragmentation, along with reports that weren't provided to the board, such as the nitrate analysis that was done by NASA, we didn't even know existed. There's a lot of new information, and I think if the board had had an opportunity to look at all of it, they'd come to a different conclusion.
Tom Stalkup, the assertion here, they didn't even have the kind of missile that would have done this damage at that time in 96, Tom.
I'm very happy Mr. Golia is joining us tonight, and he made that statement. He said that they knew right away it couldn't have been a shoulder-fired missile, but if you read their final report, that's what they looked for, evidence of a shoulder-fired missile. And they said, hey, we didn't find any evidence of a shoulder-fired missile, so there wasn't any evidence of a missile. And the word proximity-fused missile does not exist in their NTSB final report.
Gail in Duxbury, Massachusetts, what do you think, Gail?
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I was just listening to this very interesting show, and the question of motive has come up a couple times. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if the researchers of this documentary were able to scrutinize the passenger list and explore the possibility. Did they ever suspect that someone famous or infamous on board may have been targeted?
An assassination that was willing to bring down 230 people with it? What about it, Tom? Did you look at the manifest?
Well, I did.
Go ahead, Hank.
As a matter of fact, about 2 weeks into the investigation, FBI special agent that I was working with came to me and said, look, there's an individual seated in first class, upper deck. We're interested in trying to recover the seat and the area around that individual and try to reconstruct that as soon as you can. I said, gotcha. And we made that a top priority. It took quite a while, but we were able to recover some of the seat components, floor decking, and that sort of thing. I passed that information on to the appropriate special agent, and as per their normal MO, heard nothing back.
But who was it? I mean, the manifest wasn't secret, was it?
Hank,
the manifest wasn't secret, and to be quite frank, I don't remember the gentleman's name. It was a Middle Eastern name, I can tell you that.
Tom, is it anywhere to go with that?
I think in the very early stages they thought it could have been a bomb, and they thought, oh, maybe this person had a bomb under him. That's why they're so interested in Hank's interior documentation of where he was sitting. But there were, you know, all sorts of rumors go around the Internet of someone, you know, being targeted by a missile. But I find that highly unlikely.
John Golia, in Hyderabad, India, what about all the witnesses, 600-plus witnesses on the ground? And you know, whether you agree or not, there did seem to be a lot of consistency in their independent testimony here. What do you make of that? Do you think they were all smoking something?
No, I don't. I don't. I mean, people see different things. I mean, we've had accidents where two people standing next to one another saw different things.
This was 650 people.
70.
Right.
670.
And that's another, we can't even agree with how many people there were. It keeps
rolling. Well, but it's a lot. Let's stipulate.
It's a lot of people. I'll give you that. I'll give you that. And I think that the film actually puts those people in three different buckets or three different places of what they've observed.
Yes.
If they were pretty consistent, then why do you need to talk to all 670 of them?
Well, I mean, well, just because 230 people died, I mean, why not have evidence from any of them in the hearings?
The FBI did the investigation. They did the interviews. Admittedly, they weren't the same type of interview that the NTSB would have done. They didn't ask the same kind of questions that Hank Hughes would have asked. But I think the basic information that was extracted from them was adequate in totality.
John, would you like to see reopened? Do you think this ought to be reopened or not, John Golia?
I have no objection to reopening any report. In fact, while I was at the board, we reopened three of them, one of them actually at my request.
Are you sure that you got this right in the first investigation?
I believe we did. I believe we did. But remember, it's a probable cause. The reports are always open. These folks have put together their petition for reconsideration. It will be reviewed by a different set of eyes than the first time. In fact, totally different since a vast majority of them have left the board, have retired. So it'll be a totally different set of eyes. And if there's anything there, I would expect the NTSB to open it up.
Tom Stalkup, do you share that confidence?
Well, one question for you, John. The person who presented the eyewitness testimony significantly distorted that testimony at the final hearing. And I'm just wondering if you think, since he's managing director, that this will get a fair shake.
Oh.
I do, because he'll be out of the loop. Because of that, because of his involvement, he will be out of the loop.
Tom, do you have confidence that your documentary may reopen this? What do you think?
Yes, I do. I think it'll be reopened.
Hank Hughes, you share that confidence?
Yes, I do.
Big question marks raised over an incident of tremendous pain for a lot of families. We don't want to make it worse, but there are the questions. Tom Stalkup and Hank Hughes in the documentary TWA Flight 800, John Golia with the NTSB, and from Hyderabad, India. Thank you all for joining us today. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.